Please remember to watch your language.
Look, I can't speak without swearing, and I've only got my grade 10, and I haven't had a cigarette since I've been arrested, and I'm ready to f***ing snap. So I'd like to make a request under the People's Freedom of Choices and Voices Act that I be able to smoke and swear in your courtroom. Because if I can't smoke and swear, I'm f***ed.
The following programming may contain content that some listeners find offensive. If you are sensitive to foul language or explicit content, please turn your radio the f*** off now.
It's the St. Teresa edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, St. Teresa. Hate speech, built to be kind, medical devices, the weather, and much, much more. Let's listen to episode 353.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross sword, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of spark stuff. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are other suns. We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. Tis I, Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. This week, in the light of the sainthood of the nun formerly known as Mother Teresa, well, let's listen into a classic Radio Free Thinker clip where we were discussing the beatification of said Mother Teresa. Let's listen and learn.
So, Ethan.
Yes.
We're going to talk about the science of the saints, which sounds a little weird to begin with, but by the end of the segment, you should understand where I'm going to be going with that. Many may remember what may have been, I think, the pinnacle of Christopher Hitchens' work is the missionary position, Mother Teresa in Theory and in Practice. Well, I came across an academic study that out of Montreal that sort of revisits and supports Hitchens' work, and I thought it'd be an interesting thing to kind of just go over briefly again. Now, Mother Teresa's been dead for about 16 years, so maybe a bit of a refresher on who she was and why she was famous. Agnes Goya Bojahau was born in, that's her real name. She was born in 1910 in Albania, which is why she has an unusual name by my ears. She left home at 18 to join the Sisters of Loreto as a missionary. She never saw her family again, which apparently was by choice. It was a little odd tidbit I picked up when I was reading all this. She started in Ireland and ended up in India, where she started up the Missionaries of Charity and became Mother Teresa. The ostensive aim of the charity is to set up hostels for the poor, sick, and infirm. It is on this basis that she became known as sort of the mother of the world. She received a Nobel Peace Prize in 1979 and was considered to be, according to Gallup polls and the other sort of ratings like that, as one of the most admired people of the century, right up there with Gandhi. Of course, another icon really falls a little bit short of the ideal when you actually delve into his history. To become a saint, which is what she's on the path to, you must have two miracles attributed to you. Teresa got the first official nod in 2003. One more, and she becomes a saint. So that's Mother Teresa. Mm. Now, in the paper that was published in March of this year, titled The Dark Side of Mother Teresa, so you get an idea what it's going to be,
yeah.
In the Journal of Studies in Religion, Lerive et al. Found the facts really debunked the myth of Mother Teresa, that she was not so saintly, not in the way that we typically think of the term, after all. And it confirms Hitchens' characterization. Duplication of research helps to ensure the confidence of the results, and that's where the sort of the science comes in. They consulted 287 documents to do their analysis that represented apparently 96% of the literature on the founder of the Order of the Mission of Charity. Where they not only debunked the saintliness of her, but shows that there's some real problems if you're a Catholic with regards to her beatification. So, first, a little bit of note. Most of this is actually based on a review by Jerry Coining. I did that because the original paper is in French. My French is a little rusty. Bonus marks for him for his work. And if there's anything wrong in this segment, it's all his fault, not mine. So let's move on. Really, they had three main areas of criticism. First is that she fetishized suffering. It's important to remember that in Mother Teresa's view of faith was that it was through suffering that we became closer to God. At the time of her death, Mother Teresa had opened 517 missions, welcoming poor and the sick in more than 100 countries. The missions had been described as homes for the dying by doctors visiting several of these establishments in Calcutta. These are not places to help the suffering, but to sort of service them in sort of a preachy kind of way. Doctors observed a significant lack of hygiene, even unfit conditions, as well as shortage of actual care, adequate food, and no painkillers. And that's an important part here, because if you had painkillers that reduced your suffering, which means it actually took you away from God in her worldview. The Lancet reported that there was a reuse of hypodermic needles and an approach to illness and suffering that ignored such basic things as actually just doing a systematic diagnosis, you know, what's actually wrong with you. Dr. Robin Fox, an editor at The Lancet, described the medical care as haphazard. There were no doctors employed, so you'd actually have volunteers without any medical knowledge making decisions about patient care. Again, the suffering was sort of the important part because there was no distinction even made between sort of terminal patients and those with curable diseases. In fact, the conditions of the mission were so bad that it meant those people who had actually treatable conditions were actually much more likely to die because of lack of treatment and poor living conditions. And of course, her foundation couldn't provide better help, not because of a lack of funds. Her foundation itself had hundreds of millions of dollars. Instead of treating the poor, she used the money to set up more missionaries to spread the gospel of suffering. When asked about the lack of actual help, she is quoted as saying, and this is very telling and disturbing, "There's something beautiful in seeing the poor accept their lot. To suffer is like Christ's passion. The world gains from their suffering," which just chills me. It is noted in the paper that when Mother Teresa herself needed palliative care, and palliative care is sort of that end-of-life care that helps reduce the suffering when you're dying, she actually went to an American hospital and had all the drugs she could get to reduce her pain. So suffering for the people, but not for the saint. Ethan, thoughts about that?
Yeah, Mother Teresa is one of the most despicable people in the history of modern religion. It's really kind of shocking that nobody knows the real story behind her.
And I think what adds to it all is we have this particular view of who she's supposed to be. Like, her image is so much bigger and grander than the person was behind it. And it is such a contrary view of what she really was. It's almost like an inverted photo, really. Because everyone thinks of her as this loving, caring, gentle person, when really she was a masochist.
Yeah, absolutely.
Another criticism comes about the money part. She was a great fundraiser and had no qualms of supporting or praising vile dictators provided they forked over the loot. Most notably, she was a great admirer of baby doc Jean-Claude Duvalier, who, along with his father, terrorized Haiti for decades. Lots of torture and that sort of thing. Although she would take the money from anywhere, her charity... her charity sort of has said, you know, had hundreds of millions of dollars. She was a real Scrooge when it came time to give it out. The paper notes that although she offered prayers for those suffering from tragedies like, you know, floods and earthquakes and that sort of thing, she never gave out any direct aid and money. Never. You know, it's always just for me, not for you. Even in the Bhopal disaster, all she gave out were her prayers, which we know how much that does.
Mm-hmm.
Any thoughts on that one, Ethan?
Well, again, it just sort of shines a light on who this person really was. And it's also remarkable that, you know, with all the attention that the Catholic Church has garnered through things like child sexual abuse, this has really sort of escaped any kind of skeptical scrutiny for decades. I mean, aside from Hitchens, I don't know too many people who have actually... Well, I mean, these people here who wrote this paper. But aside from them, I don't know many people who have ever mentioned this.
No, you know, and again, it's current now in one sense because she's being used as one of those poster childs as her beatification and sainthood and canonization is coming up. So it's not like, okay, she was a bad person, she's now dead, let's move on. Her charity is still going on, and from all reports, they're continuing on with this sort of cult of suffering. The last criticism I'm going to mention here is actually ones that would be of concern to our Catholic listeners. Do we have any Catholic listeners?
I don't anymore.
Well, maybe you have friends who are Catholic. Anyway, the first alarm bells go off when you realize that she was actually rushed into this process of beatification and canonization. Tradition states that 5 years must pass before they can start doing an investigation. But Pope John Paul II started the investigation almost immediately, or building the case. I think it was about a year after her death. Mm-hmm. The miracles that were attributed to her were not actual miracles. I know you're saying, yes, Don, you're an atheist. This is one of your knee-jerk reactions. No, even by sort of religious Catholic standards, this one fails. So the miracle attributed to Mother Teresa was the healing of a woman who suffered intense abdominal pain caused by a cancerous tumor. The woman testified that she was cured when she put a medallion blessed by Mother Teresa on her abdomen, and it all went away. Wow, cured by a medallion. That's a miracle. I mean, not by my standards, but by their standards. Sure, yeah, it qualifies. Alas, it was not mysterious, and actually it wasn't even cancer. Her doctor, who may know a thing or two about what the actual medical conditions were, said that she didn't actually have cancer, but it was a cyst caused by tuberculosis, and that after about a year of drug treatment, the TB was cured and the cyst went away. Even her husband reported, I thought this was funny, even her husband reported as saying that my wife was cured by a doctor and not by any miracle. I just love the dinner conversation.
Yeah.
The author ended with the question that... And now this is the author of the study that was just recently done. What would be better than beatification followed by canonization of this model to revitalize the church, inspire the faithful, especially at a time when churches are emptying and the Roman Catholic authority is declined? Essentially, they're saying, listen, this whole canonization process, it's politics. It's just designed to improve the brand. Now, you might ask, so what? Well, more or less knew all this thanks to Hitchens. But what makes this important is that, well, Hitchens was a new atheist, and you can always say, well, this was sort of a hatchet job. This new paper was actually an academic paper written by appropriate people, i.e. specialists in the field. It was published in a peer-review journal that was prestigious. It was well-recognized as a good one. So as I started, the gold standard to sort of science is replication. So if 2 or 10 people do an experiment or a study and they get the same results, you can be pretty much sure that you've got the truth. And it seems like we much more confident now of the truth about Mother Teresa.
Yeah, definitely the rush to get her into sort of the Saints Club, it definitely sort of just smells like a tourist trap, like they just can't wait to start selling little Mother Teresa idols. And it's just such a transparent ploy.
Well, and it was actually, I don't have the quote handy with me, but Pope John Paul II believed saints were good for the faith. It was good for people to have. He was responsible for the beatification of over 1,300 people, the canonization or sainthood of over 400 people, and he said that they were good cheerleaders, that they helped bring the faith, that it didn't matter whether they were real miracles or not. It was good for the faithful. And he believed it so much that under his watch, more people gained sainthood than all the previous popes before him. It was hilarious. Before the show, I was talking to Ian, and I was saying one of the perks of the show, well, actually, we talked about this right at the beginning, was be a beatification, is you get a feast day attributed to you. Well, how many of them have to have, like, 3 or 4 different feasts on that one day? Because, you have the morning feast for St. Teresa, and you have the dinner feast for St. Paul, and you have the evening feast for, Catholics are going to get big. We'll return after this break.
Hey there.
Barev.
We're the Armenian Students Association, and we're here to bring together everyone,
Armenians and non-Armenians,
who are interested in learning about the Armenian culture here at UBC.
Find us on Facebook at ASAUBC to stay up to date. We look forward to seeing you at our future events.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker on 101.9 FM, your saint-free zone for skeptical thinking. And we're back. Next up, we have a clip from Crash Course Philosophy that tackles the tricky world of hate speech. A reminder, trigger words will be said. Let's listen and learn.
A warning. This episode of Crash Course Philosophy contains language that may be upsetting for some viewers and may not be appropriate for viewing in certain settings.
Consider the following sentence. Jason shot a mouse in his boxer shorts. Simple enough. Or is it?
Like, my first thought was that Jason was wearing the boxer shorts when he shot the mouse. But maybe the mouse was wearing Jason's boxer shorts, or maybe the mouse was wearing his own boxer shorts, or was the mouse in Jason's boxer shorts while he was wearing them? And while we're at it, what kind of shooting are we talking about? Was it done with a gun or with a camera? Words can go wrong in lots of different ways. And when they do, the problem usually comes down to the distinction between speaker meaning and audience meaning, or what a speaker intends, as opposed to what a listener understands. When these two meanings don't match up, the results can range from confusing to hilarious. But words don't only convey meaning. They can also relate attitudes. And when a speaker's attitude doesn't match that of their audience, their words, whether they were intended to just be funny or edgy or dirty, can end up being seriously harmful. And now is the part where I warn you that we're going to talk about some of those harmful words today. I'm going to say them, even though I'm not going to like it. You are going to hear them. You also probably won't like it. And we're both going to know what they mean. But we have to talk about them because they're everywhere and they're powerful. Let's start out with a harmless example of miscommunication, our mouse in boxer shorts. The reason that sentence is so confusing is because we understand most language by context. But sometimes, like in a lone sentence about a mouse, the context just isn't there. And the result is often ambiguity, when a statement has more than one plausible interpretation. But there are other times when we do have context, but it isn't enough. Because there's the context that you share with your interlocutor, stuff that's known to both of you, like how mice don't wear underwear. But there's also the personal context that each of you brings to the conversation. Like, if somebody makes a stupid off-the-cuff joke about your mother, that could turn out to be really painful if your mother has recently died. There are other kinds of unintentional linguistic harm as well, some of which I'm sure you've encountered probably in texts or emails. One person says something as a joke, but the other person reads it as serious and takes offense. These are cases where the speaker tried to flout one of Grice's maxims that we talked about by, say, using sarcasm or irony, but the audience was using the cooperative principle and assumed that everyone involved was saying what they really meant. So a sarcastic text, if read without the help of social cues like tone of voice or body language, can end up creating miscommunication. But when it comes to the injuries caused by language, the greater concern for us here is words that are deliberately chosen to cause harm. Now, let's pause for a moment here to talk about how we talk about harmful language. Philosophers often rely on what's known as the use-mention distinction. This is the difference between talking about a word and talking with the word. Let's look at the difference between using the word philosophy and simply mentioning it. Consider this statement. I have a hard time staying awake in my philosophy class after lunch. Right there, I used the word philosophy. But when I say philosophy is a Greek word meaning love of wisdom, I'm mentioning the word or talking about it. The use-mention distinction is helpful when we talk about sensitive or taboo words because we have to use them in order to talk about them. And there are many kinds of taboo words. Some are considered off-limits because they are, for lack of a more philosophical word, dirty. Dirty words are scatological, blue, coarse. They refer to things like body parts, bodily functions, and sexual acts. You probably don't want to use these words in polite company, but if they do offend people, it's because they offend their sensibilities and not, say, their ideas about themselves or their identity. These words are used for emphasis, to shock, and to express strong attitudes, but their point isn't to target a person. Their point isn't to harm. In contrast, hate speech consists of words that are directed at a member of a group, and they're used specifically because of that person's membership in that group. These groups are generally based on something that's key to a person's identity, like race, ethnicity, gender, sexual orientation, or religion. Hate speech is typically understood as more morally problematic than dirty words because hate speech is designed to hurt. But how can mere words cause harm? To understand this, we need to talk about a linguistic phenomenon known as thick concepts. These are words or ideas that come preloaded not just with descriptive meaning, but also with evaluative content. There are attitudes and values that are baked into these words that are hard, if not impossible, to unbake. For instance, murder is a thick concept that contains a description. It means to kill someone. But it also contains evaluation. Murder is unjustified killing. There's no such thing as a good murder. Now, with this concept in mind, let's consider a theory about how certain words cause harm, posed by American lawyer Charles R. Lawrence III. Lawrence argues that hate speech should be legally punishable in the United States, just as it is in some other countries. His argument focuses on thick concepts that are used to disparage a person for simply being who they are. What's problematic about these concepts, he says, is that you can't pull their descriptive meaning away from their inherent negativity, Both the meaning and the attitude are tied up in a single word. Let me give you an example, a word that I am going to have a hard time saying. It's a hateful word, but we can't pretend it doesn't exist, because in a sense, that mentality, the idea that certain words shouldn't be discussed and analyzed and argued about, gives these words even more power. The word I want to talk about is faggot. This word has descriptive content in that it's commonly used to describe a homosexual man. But that description is bound up with an inherently hateful attitude, so much so that the target of the word is unable to separate that attitude from the fact about his identity. The word hurts because it tells the target that an essential part of his identity is bad. Being told that you're wearing an ugly shirt or that you have a stupid haircut might sting, but those aren't essential parts of you. If you're told that who you are is inherently bad or wrong, then you're being hit to your core. The point of using a word like that is to harm. That's all it's used for. That is its sole purpose. And Lawrence argues that while free speech is important to democracy, hate speech should not be protected. Instead, he says, hate speech should be understood as belonging to the class of speech known as fighting words. And yes, that's an actual term. They're not just for cartoon cowboys. Fighting words are words that are meant to incite violence. And since the point of protecting speech is to promote open communication, Lawrence says, words that are designed to replace communication with violence and fear don't deserve constitutional protection. Contemporary American philosopher Stephanie Ross offers another explanation of the way that words can harm. Let's head over to the thought bubble to explore it with some flash philosophy. Rather than focusing on words that most people would agree are negative, Ross deals with words that generally seem innocuous. Think of the word baby, used as a term of endearment among adults, particularly applied to women. Nothing wrong with calling your significant other baby, right? Well, Ross thinks there might be. She says that words people use to refer to us can create what's known as metaphorical identification. Think about the characteristics of your average baby: helpless, dependent, relying on others to care for them, to make decisions for them. Ross argues that when a person is repeatedly referred to with a word like baby, a metaphorical identification gradually takes place, whereby she begins to think of herself as having those traits. In other words, she starts to see herself as powerless and dependent, as someone who relies on others, particularly the men who call her that, to take care of her. This might sound far-fetched, but think about it. The way we think of ourselves is largely shaped by what we believe others think of us, and we tend to act according to the expectations that we think others have of us. So a child who knows he's thought of as a troublemaker is more likely to continue acting out, while a child who's perceived as a winner is more likely to push himself to win. To be clear, Ross doesn't think this is something that happens consciously. She sees it as insidious, eating away at our self-perception without us even being aware of it. The words people use to refer to us end up informing the way we understand ourselves. Thanks, Thought Bubble. Now, what about hurtful words that you probably wouldn't classify as hate speech? I'm talking about more prevalent language, the kind we use in the cafeteria, in dorms, when talking to our friends, or talking about our enemies. They're hurtful, but they're powerful in a somewhat different way because they're almost mainstream. And because we see them as less threatening, no big deal, they could actually be more likely to cause unintentional harm. So consider another word that I really don't want to say, slut. This is another thick concept. It has descriptive content in that it's used to refer to women who have casual sex, but it's the evaluative content that really does the work when this word is used. The attitudes that are baked into this word, attitudes specifically about women and sexuality, are so potent that it's even used to describe women who don't have casual sex. People use it to describe women who just, like, wear clothes that they consider revealing. And the word is meant to mean that kind of woman is bad. The attitude and the description are all bound up together. Now, maybe you have opinions and reasons for those opinions that you feel justify using this word, but it might also be the case that you don't actually think there's anything wrong with having casual sex or wearing certain kinds of clothes. So you might want to think twice about using a word like that. Because when you use it, you're signaling a specific attitude to other people. You're endorsing that attitude. So if it's an attitude you don't really hold and one you don't think others should hold, you should take care not to spread it through your speech. Okay, now let me make just one more point. No one is telling you what you should or shouldn't say here. That's not my job. My job is to help you scrutinize, with a philosopher's distance, the language that we all use. The philosophy of language can help us bring scary, powerful words out into the open and figure out why they're scary and powerful. And then, with reasoned arguments, we can understand and explain how the language that we use can inflict harm on others. Obviously, deliberately deliberately using words to harm is awful. But even if you don't intend hate with the words you use, your audience might not understand that, because speaker meaning and audience meaning don't always match up. Only by thinking seriously about the words we use and what they mean can we understand how they might be perceived by others. Today, we talked about words and how they hurt. We learned about the use-mention distinction, the difference between dirty words and hate speech, and we also learned about thick concepts and metaphorical identification.
As a counter to hate speech, here's a clip from Fig One about how we're built to be kind. Let's be uplifted.
One of the hardest questions when you think about the evolution of the human species from the standard framework of evolution, which really is about individual survival, competing, getting your genes to the next generation. One of the hardest questions within that framework is, why are people so frequently and routinely good and generous and sacrificing, right? And, you know, most people think that Darwin had this idea of survival of the fittest, that really it's the most ruthless and bloodthirsty who really thrive and survive. That is not Darwin's view of human evolution at all. He really felt that sympathy is the strongest instinct that humans have. Communities that have the most sympathetic members will flourish and raise the greatest number of offspring. That notion of Darwin's led to this sense that out of the vulnerability of our offspring emerged, first of all, social structures like cooperative caregiving, and then also physiological systems shaped by evolution to help us take care of the carriers of our genes, our offspring. We have learned from neuroscience down at UCLA that if you feel physical pain, a part of your brain lights up. And if I see you have that physical pain, the same part of my brain lights up. It's as if we're wired to have the same experience of other people. Empathy is this really complicated task. It really engages the frontal lobes, these newer regions of the cortex that are involved in more complex symbolic processes like language and imagining the future. Because empathy requires that you think there's someone else out there who has feelings and thoughts that may be different from mine. That's a really complicated cognitive achievement. In my lab, the Berkeley Social Interaction Lab, we showed images of prototypical suffering to our participants. They trigger massively powerful reactions of compassion, and what we found in the brain is that a very old part of the brain called the periaqueductal gray, which is common to mammals when they take care of things, lights up when you feel compassion. So that tells us compassion is really old in the nervous system, as Darwin speculated. My students and I got really interested in social class. What does it do to the human mind? Our lab and other labs are interested in something called the vagus nerve. It's the longest bundle of nerves in the human nervous system. In our research, compassion, the feeling of caring for someone in need, activates the vagus nerve. Lower class individuals, if we show them images of suffering, they have a vagus nerve response. You don't see that in upper class individuals. It literally is a compassion deficit that's produced by lots of wealth. Next set of studies on charity, who gives? Economic analyses would say, if I have a lot of money, it should be easy to give. If I have 900 bucks in my bank account, giving away money, it really matters. You know, it matters what you put in your fridge. And in spite of that, what we find is lower class individuals give more. And this is replicated in studies of philanthropy. You know, one of the things that this science tells us is there is enormous strength in these poorer communities of generosity and empathy that, you know, many people in more privileged circumstances miss. It's strong community. Yeah, you know, 60% of what we do is really about maximizing an individual's personal gratification and desire, just the classic survival of the most competitive. But 40% of the time, we're really doing things for other people. And we sacrifice and we risk exploitation and we still do it. And not only that, but it actually becomes personally fulfilling and inspiring to engage in that work. We find these secondary delights in acting on behalf of others. And I think that it really requires that we have to redefine human self-interest. You know, the great ethical traditions have always been encouraging this. And now we're seeing the science say, yeah, the brain really cares about other people.
And we'll return after this break.
Attention grad students, share your research, find out what's going on in other disciplines, approach your work from a new angle. Check out Fire Talks, the interdisciplinary discussion forum sponsored by the Research Commons at Kerner Library. Visit bit.ly/firetalk for more information.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker on 101.9 FM, Vancouver, Canada. Your bulwark against hate speech and source of kindness. On a special note, for those who may be listening, there will be links provided on the website for all the clips we're playing. And we're back. You may think that pacemakers or replacement hips, hell, even the defibrillators in the sports arenas, are carefully checked and proven safe and effective. Well, as we're about to learn, maybe not so much. Thanks to this clip from Healthcare Triage.
Things sometimes go wrong with airbags, food, and drugs, prompting recalls. It can also happen with medical devices, though you'd think life-saving devices like heart defibrillators or artificial hips would be closely monitored. But the data needed to systematically and rapidly identify dangerous medical devices are not routinely collected in the United States. Why not? It wouldn't be that hard to do. That's the topic of this week's Healthcare Triage. Special thanks to Austin Fracht, who wrote the Upshot column from which this episode was adapted. Problems with medical devices aren't rare. Defibrillators implanted in nearly 200,000 patients were recalled in 2011 because of a faulty part. More recently, the Escher birth control device implanted in women's fallopian tubes have been associated with pain and deaths. Improper handling of duodenoscopes, used by doctors to examine the small intestine, was linked to hundreds of cases of antibiotic-resistant infections in 2013 and 14. According to a report from the Brookings Institution, medical device problems that we know about contribute to about 3,000 deaths per year in the United States. There may be many more we don't know about because we don't track medical device use the way we track prescription drugs for quality and safety. Codes that uniquely identify prescribed drugs are routinely included in medical claims data, such as those made public by the Medicare program. These can be mined for signals of problems. But for medical devices, we rely on a passive system that's not up to the task. Hospitals, nursing homes, and medical device manufacturers and importers are required to notify the FDA of device safety problems. Doctors, nurses, and other healthcare professionals are not. The FDA has characterized the data collected through these channels as potentially, and I'm quoting, incomplete, inaccurate, untimely, unverified, or biased. Reflecting this haphazard approach, a Senate report released recently accused Olympus, a Japanese manufacturer of contaminated duodenoscopes, of delayed reporting of known problems and chided the FDA for its lethargic investigation of them. The report also found that none of the hospitals where problems surfaced properly documented them. Experts convened by the FDA excoriated the manufacturer of the Escher birth control device for not collecting data that could have detected its risks. The solution seems simple. Do for devices what we do for drugs. The FDA established the Sentinel Initiative to mine medical data to confirm or clear suspected problematic drugs. For example, one inquiry confirmed reports of intestinal problems associated with an antihypertensive drug. Another investigated whether a new anticoagulant drug was associated with a higher risk of bleeding than others. We can't have a Sentinel Initiative for medical devices in the United States because unique device identifiers aren't required to be included in standardized medical claims data. Though claims reveal what procedure is performed on which patient, they don't indicate what exact devices were used, like which of the dozens of makes and models of artificial hips were implanted in a hip replacement. There are plans to make it easier for hospitals to use their electronic records to track which devices are used in which patients, but those records aren't standardized, as claims data are, and don't fully integrate with those from other systems, severely limiting their use for surveillance and patient safety. Other nations have detected issues with such monitoring systems before America.
Mostly sunny. If you ever thought it was difficult to tell the difference between partly cloudy and mostly sunny, well, you're not alone. Established by the National Weather Service, NWS, according to a loose set of rules, the criteria used to describe different elements of your forecast can get pretty vague. Sky conditions are classified according to how much opaque cloud coverage, OCC, is expected that day. While the NWS has apparently not defined opaque clouds, they are presumed to be those that can't be seen through, or more technically, those that are opaque to terrestrial radiation. To qualify as sunny, there can be no more than 25% OCC. Clear, on the other hand, is sometimes used as a synonym for sunny, but is only applied when there is no more than 5% OCC. Mostly clear, which is also a synonym for sunny, is used when there is between 6% and 25% OCC. Mostly sunny and partly cloudy are apparently interchangeable and apply when the OCC is between 26% and 50%. Partly sunny and mostly cloudy can also be synonyms when the OCC is between 51% and 69%, although mostly cloudy can be applied for OCC up to 87%. At an OCC of 88% and above, the sky is considered cloudy or overcast. Note that when there is a high probability of precipitation, 60% or more, many weather folks skip the sky condition forecast since it may be assumed to be cloudy. When forecasting the chance of precipitation, the NWS considers the likelihood that there will be at least 0.01 inches of precipitation at one place in the forecast area within usually a 12-hour period, called the probability of precipitation, or POP. Words used in the forecast, such as chance of rain and likely, as well as isolated and scattered, are considered either expressions of uncertainty or qualifiers. The last two denote that the entire area will not be affected, and they are tied to the ranges of POPs. So when the probability of precipitation, POP, is between 60% and 70%, the uncertainty is low, and so the forecast may often include the word likely, while when the POP is only 20%, the uncertainty is higher, so the phrase slight chance may be used. Isolated is used when the POP is between 10% and 29%, while scattered is used when the POP is between 30% and 59%. Occasional, intermittent, and periods of denote a POP of greater than 79%, but also that the precipitation will be on and off. When the forecast temperature is in a given range, it has a particular meaning as well. For example, near 40 means the temperature is expected to be from 38 Fahrenheit to 42 Fahrenheit. Lower 40s denotes anywhere from 40 Fahrenheit to 44 Fahrenheit, and mid-40s from 43 Fahrenheit to 47 Fahrenheit, and upper-40s from 46 Fahrenheit to 49 Fahrenheit. Wind terms are tied to specific ranges too, all related to sustained wind speed, SWS, and they can overlap. Sustained wind is defined as the average of observed wind speeds over a 2-minute period. High, strong, and damaging winds are those expected to have an SWS of at least 40 miles per hour, MPH. Very windy denotes when the SWS is between 30 and 40 miles per hour, and windy between anywhere from 20 to 35 miles per hour. When the SWS is between 15 and 25 miles per hour, breezy is used when the weather is mild, and brisk or blustery are used when it is cold. Calm and light are used to denote SWS of 5 miles per hour or less. Wind chill incorporates considerations of how much heat a human body will lose to the environment on a cold or windy day. Calculations are estimated at weather conditions at 5 feet above ground level, said to be the typical height of a human face, and begin when SWS reaches 3 miles per hour. The NWS provides a chart that shows wind chill for any temperature between 40 Fahrenheit and minus 45 Fahrenheit, with winds between 5 miles per hour and 60 miles per hour, and it reveals that even a slight wind with cold temperatures can have a big effect on wind chill. For example, at 0 Fahrenheit, with only calm winds of 5 miles per hour, the wind chill is minus 11 Fahrenheit. Likewise, even when temperatures are relatively mild, say 35 Fahrenheit, if the winds are high, say 60 miles per hour, it can make it feel like about half the temperature it really is, 17 Fahrenheit. On the other hand, the heat index reflects the fact that when the humidity reaches a certain point, the perspiration on your skin can't evaporate, you can't cool down so easily, and so the apparent temperature feels hotter than it actually is.
On that note, the NWS provides a heat index chart as well, which shows temperatures between 80 Fahrenheit and 110 Fahrenheit and relative humidity, RH, between 40% and 100%. Just as with Windchill, slight changes in a single variable can have a dramatic effect, and when both are high, the heat index becomes dangerous to human health. For example, at 90 Fahrenheit and 40% relative humidity, the heat index is only 91 Fahrenheit. But if it's soupy outside, say 95% relative humidity, then the heat index shoots up to 127 Fahrenheit.
And we'll return after this break.
Stressed lately? UBC Yoga Club is here to offer you a peace of mind. Come out to any of our 17 weekly classes running 7 days a week, ranging from 8 a.m. to 7 p.m. We have a class to accommodate your needs and abilities. Check us out at ubcyogaclub.com.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker, your partly political and mainly skeptical radio broadcast. And we're back. We here in Vancouver know about traffic and how it can be a source of frustration. Have you ever wondered how animals deal with traffic jams? Well, vis-a-vis ants, wonder no longer. From this clip from It's Okay to Be Smart, we'll learn how they deal with it. Let's listen and learn.
With more than 7 billion people on Earth and one car for every six of us, traffic is bad just about everywhere. Last year, American drivers wasted nearly a million collective years staring at each other's taillights. The average driver in London has it the worst, spending more than 4 days a year in gridlock.
It's Big Ben, kids, Parliament.
But Earth is home to another great commuter whose populations number in the trillions, and they don't get stuck in traffic. An army ant's day is a lot like ours, set off in the morning alongside thousands of our neighbors, moving out and back in neat little lines so we can provide for our brood. I mean, family. Crowding, bottlenecks, slowpokes, ants face the same traffic challenges that we do, but they don't get in traffic jams, which is why scientists are looking to them for solutions to human traffic. In a perfect world, cars could pack in bumper to bumper and drive at that magic speed, but we're not perfect. One wrong tap on the gas or brakes and... Come on! What? Keep getting moving! When speed and density hit a tipping point, jams are inevitable. Yet in the ant world, traffic jams don't happen, even when things get crowded. The easiest solution to an overcrowded road is just make it bigger. But ants can't just cut trails as wide as they want. Wider roads take time and energy to maintain, and the pheromones that mark them become weaker. So instead, ants get organized. It might not look like it, but there's lanes here. Ants headed back to the colony loaded up with food use the center lane, while outbound ants stay to the edges. But why three lanes and not two, like our roads? Well, when two ants are on a collision course, eventually one's gotta give. The loaded inbound ants are less maneuverable, so the empty-handed ant almost always turns first, half the time to either side, and voila! Three lanes, no crashes, no traffic jams. If you think you're so different from an army ant, pay attention next time you're in a busy crosswalk. We naturally form similar lanes in crowds, mindless individuals contributing to a larger pattern. But put us behind the wheel, and this happens. There's a simple reason we hate traffic, because we hate waiting in line. Queuing up plays weird tricks on our brain's sense of time. Occupied time feels shorter than unoccupied time. This is why people listen to the radio or play that license plate game. And it's the same reason supermarkets put magazines in the checkout lines. Ever been late for a big meeting and felt like the whole universe is standing in your way? Well, anxiety makes waits seem longer. Ever been in a traffic jam with no obvious cause? It's the worst. Uncertain or unexplained waits are longer than known or explained waits. But traffic engineers have learned that simple information signs can change how we experience delays. But more than anything else, we hate unfair waits. You see a sign that says, lane closed ahead, so you get over with plenty of time to spare, only see some jerk zip past you and get over at the last second. What, you can't wait like the rest of us, Mr. Hurry Pants? Quick side note. Gonna let you in on a little secret. Traffic researchers have found that late merging is actually better. If everyone just drives up to the bottleneck, goes one by one like a zipper, traffic moves up to 15% faster. We use both lanes at max capacity, nobody gets cheated, everybody wins. The more you know. And where were we? Our innate sense of what's fair leads to the biggest psychological illusion that we experience on the road. Why does traffic always move faster in the other lane? Well, spoilers first, it doesn't. Let's say two cars enter your standard stop-and-go traffic jam side by side. Let's count the time each one spends passing versus getting past. One driver zips past a few cars in the other lane, only to stop and wait and watch other cars pass. And then go! Woohoo! And then wait. Even if the two cars can cross some invisible finish line together the same way they started, each driver will feel like they spent more time being passed than passing, because they did. Our brains pay more attention to the losses than the gains. And all of this points to the real problem with traffic, our ego. Human drivers care about minimizing their travel time and don't give two f**ks about what other drivers want.
Driving slower may be faster for everyone else, but it's not faster for me.
I don't care if we all get where we're going at the same time. I don't like being passed.
When leafcutter ants get stuck on a twig behind a heavily loaded slowpoke, do they honk and yell bad ant words? No, they simply slow down and march behind the ant returning with the goods, because that's what's best for the group. Worker ants are all related and working towards the same goal, the good of the colony. That's the cooperative genetic programming that underlies their awesome traffic systems. The fact that we have big, complicated brains is the very reason that we get stuck in traffic and ants don't. We think of traffic as something that happens to us, rather than admitting that we are the problem. Ants are essentially tiny machines with simple programming. Put them on a trail with a few rules, allow individuals to communicate and interact with each other, and voila, you got complex traffic networks running at near maximum efficiency. Sound familiar? It should. That's basically what we'll get when we stop letting our egos drive and put traffic in the hands of a network of self-driving cars optimized to serve the collective good. Sure, sentient machines may enslave humanity, but at least they'll cut down on our commute. Stay curious.
Risky mental whiplash, our next bit of web wisdom is from SciShow that talks about fire extinguishers and how they're not all the same. Let's listen and stay safe.
So you've just caught a whiff of something burning. You run to the stove and see that your bacon has burst into flames. Thinking fast, you grab the fire extinguisher from your closet and spray the growing fire before it gets out of control. Luckily, it was the right type of fire extinguisher. Different fuels create different types of fires, and each one needs to be extinguished using a specific strategy. Depending on the chemistry between the fire and the extinguishing agent, the fire might go out, or it could actually spread. Fire comes from a chemical combustion reaction between oxygen and fuel. The fuel can be anything from wood to metal to grease. When it's heated to a very high temperature, what's called the ignition temperature, and when there's oxygen around, a fire starts. Then a chain reaction will add heat to the fire, keeping it going. Oxygen, fuel, heat, and that chemical chain reaction make up what's known as the fire tetrahedron, and a fire extinguisher works by removing at least one of these elements. Before fire extinguishers, people used water to put out fires because they knew that it worked. Water removes a crucial part of the fire tetrahedron, heat. But depending on the intensity of the fire and what's fueling it, water isn't always enough to put a fire out. That's why many countries have fire class systems, which categorize fires according to what they're fueled by. Fire extinguishers, meanwhile, are categorized based on which of these fires they can put out. In the US, the five main types of fires are A, B, C, D, and K. A Class A fire is one fueled by common materials like wood, paper, cloth, plastic, or rubber. And a Class A fire extinguisher can put out a Class A fire. The most common type of Class A extinguisher just has water in it. To put out Class A fires, water is all you really need. A Class B fire can be fueled by flammable liquids like gasoline or paint, or by flammable gases like propane. A water-based fire extinguisher can't be used on a Class B fire because the stream will just spread around the fuel and the fire. But any fire extinguisher that can block the fire's oxygen supply works well. Class C fires are caused by energized electrical equipment like appliances or motors. Water is not a good way to put out an electrical fire, since the electricity can be conducted through the water and shock anyone standing in a puddle. Class A, Class D, and Class K extinguishers all contain water-based suppressants, making them both ineffective and dangerous for Class C fires. Carbon dioxide extinguishers, on the other hand, are perfect for both Class B and C fires, since they replace the oxygen surrounding the flame with non-conductive CO2, effectively suffocating the fire without spreading it. Also, when the carbon dioxide leaves the extinguisher, it uses up some energy to expand, lowering its temperature. This super chilly discharge helps reduce the fire's heat. The most common fire extinguisher used in households today is the multi-purpose dry chemical extinguisher, which can put out Class A, B, and C fires. ABC extinguishers often contain monoammonium phosphate, a material that's also commonly used in fertilizer. Monoammonium phosphate leaves a blanket of non-flammable dust on the fire's fuel that separates it from the surrounding oxygen, smothering the flames. But even a dry chemical extinguisher can't put out a Class D fire, which is fueled by combustible metals like magnesium, titanium, sodium, or potassium. Machine shops that manufacture metal parts, like nuts and bolts, are at the highest risk of Class D fires, largely because their work produces so-called metal sawdust, shavings that turn into fantastic kindling when they're hit by a stray welding spark. Combusting metal reacts violently with the materials found in dry chemical extinguishers and releases toxic gas into the air. Plus, an ABC extinguisher's high-pressure spray can blow the metal dust and shavings around and potentially spread the fire. So if there's metal on fire, you're really gonna want a Class D extinguisher. They're also called dry powder extinguishers, and they spray at a lower pressure so they don't spread metal particles around. And they contain graphite and sodium chloride, which don't react with burning metals. Instead, they work both by absorbing the heat of the fire and by separating the fuel from the oxygen. The last type of fire is Class K. Class K fires feed off of grease, oil, and fat. They're the kind of fires that normally happen in restaurant kitchens. The acid in many oils and fats prevents dry chemicals from creating a foam blanket to smother the fire. And water molecules quickly spread out when they hit hot oil, creating a steamy, fiery explosion. Plus, water can splash oil onto flaming stove burners, which could ignite and spread the fire even more. Instead, Class K wet chemical fire extinguishers contain alkaline compounds, or basic compounds. These combine with the acid in the cooking oils and fats to create a soapy layer on the surface of the oils, which extinguishes the fire. If it's hard to keep track of which type of fire is which, there's a clever mnemonic. Class A leaves ash, Class B boils, Class C has a current, Class D has dense materials, and Class K happens in the kitchen. Remember that, and you'll know exactly which fire extinguisher to use to save your bacon.
Our last clip is from School of Life, and they discuss what a perfect country would look like. Let's listen and learn.
This is a film about the perfect country. It doesn't yet exist, and it may never, but thinking about it is no idle daydream. Sketching utopias is a way to address current problems and understand how to solve them. Focusing on the ideal version of something helps us more clearly define what we feel is wrong with what we have. Utopias bring our plans for reform into focus. Here, therefore, are a few glimpses of what the best place in the world might be like. In the perfect country, people are, perhaps surprisingly, still very busy working. Everyone isn't on holiday while robots do the work. That's because people know that when it's the right sort, work can be far more fulfilling than leisure. What people mean by the right sort of work is work that feels meaningful. That is, work that leaves one with a sense at the end of a working day that one's made a genuine improvement to the lives of others, and that one's done so through the exercise of some of one's distinctive and higher talents and skills. That's a lot more fun than sunbathing. To get to this point in the perfect country, a lot of time is spent drilling into people's characters from an early age in order to determine what sort of work they'd be best suited to. Realizing the potential of every worker is pretty much the national priority. The perfect country is rife with a new breed of entrepreneur. Like the entrepreneurs of old, they want to make money, but they want something else too, to properly and deeply satisfy their customers. There's no selling of bullshit here, even if it flatters the balance sheet. Naturally, aiming to make a profit while doing something meaningful is a very hard double act to pull off. That's why entrepreneurs are so lauded here. It's deeply taboo to be a philanthropist in perfect land because having enormous surplus wealth is generally a sign you've probably been extracting rather too much cash from your business and have not been courageous enough to risk money investing in properly meaningful goals. In the perfect country, respect is given not just for becoming wealthy, but for how serious the problem was that you fixed while making your wealth. There are famous people in the perfect land, but not the usual suspects. Here, celebrities are exemplars of qualities we really need in our everyday lives. One of the most famous people in the country won the Good Apology Contest last year. Few of us are ever called to be movie stars or great singers, so these aren't the names people know about here. The curriculum is reverse-engineered from the things that used to give people most trouble in the old world. Therefore, there's extensive study of things like how to find your vocation and settle into a job you can love, how to be confident, diffuse conflicts, and know your own mind, how to have satisfying relationships, and, this is a huge class, how to wind down and not lose your temper. A sign of being well-educated isn't erudition, it's being happy and kind. People are incredibly unromantic in the perfect country. That's why, unsurprisingly, relationships go so much better here. People don't talk endlessly about finding the right person. They know there's no such thing. Romantic enthusiasm is deeply frowned upon and seen as the enemy of love. People are extremely emotionally literate about their feelings. Psychotherapy has high prestige. It's not unusual to hear someone say, "Your transference is interfering with my projection of your ego ideal." People have a really good grasp of their own craziness and how it might affect their relationships. It's not uncommon for people on a first date to ask one another quite good-naturedly, "And so, in what way are you crazy?" Human fragility is a given, as is the need to treat it with sympathy. There's a routine assumption here that no one has a clue how to bring up a child, just as no one knows, by intuition, how to land a plane or perform brain surgery. That's why everyone is given a good deal of training. Classes start from an early age. You can, of course, have a baby without doing the training, but that would be like a mountaineer setting out to climb an Alp in their slippers. Evidence of the success of the nationwide parenting program is that hardly any 11-year-olds want to be famous or unusually good-looking. The last person whose life was ruined by a messed-up childhood died several decades ago. There are some quite bad things on the news in the perfect country, but no one comes away terrified or incandescent with rage. The nightly news, which is drawn up and read by philosophers, provides a subterranean lesson in maturity and calm. The news isn't just any old thing that happened today. Its purpose is to guide people to the information that can best help them and their country to flourish. It's an applied branch of one of the country's biggest industries, wisdom. In the perfect country, very few people still believe, but the population as a whole feels quite sympathetic to what religions used to bring, especially community, ritual, and morality, and they found some inspiring substitutes. People gather in new kinds of secular temples dedicated to important qualities. There are temples to calm and temples to community, temples to forgiveness and to kindness. There are rituals for all the major life stages, and the best writer in the country has recently written a secular liturgy for weddings and funerals. There's a replacement also for the Ten Commandments, which makes a big deal of the idea that most people are mean through anxiety and vulnerability rather than strength or evil. In the perfect country, people love art, but they've entirely given up on the strange idea that art should be for art's sake. Being an artist is a job with a very practical purpose. It's to make the best ideas vivid and persuasive so that we can keep them at the front of our minds at all times. Art is there to remind us to be calm, forgiving, open to experience, and properly awed by all that exceeds us. It's a therapeutic medium which is judged to be part of the National Health Service. In the perfect country, the cities are beautiful, partly because there are very few architects around, and originality in design is really frowned upon. So rather than call in architects every time a new building is required, developers here just follow templates that have already been shown to work. Six-story high buildings with large windows, contemporary forms and natural materials abound. You build densely, don't give up all roads to cars, and make sure that the streets are lively. As a result of this beautiful, slightly boring predictability, there's very little NIMBYism and property prices stay reasonable. Though people love nature, they're never that unhappy when a new development is announced, as none of us would be if Venice or Bath was about to be built in a field near us. That's the sort of standard of beauty expected and delivered by developments in the perfect country. People accept that they need help with many things, so there's no terror at living in quite a paternalistic, or even you might call it nannying, culture. The perfect country is a complete democracy. Therefore, people know and trust that the government is always acting to defend citizens' own best long-term interests. It's a force enabling them to realize their true potential. That's why the government bans business doing certain quite unhelpful things, and why there are shows on TV about how to be a kinder person. It's not spooky, because it's properly, democratically sincere. People are grateful in the